Hello and welcome to the February 2013 edition of the Sands and its Storm Center's monthly threat update. My name is Johannes Ulrich, recording here from Jacksonville, Florida. And as usual, we will have two parts to this webcast. First part, which is what you're listening to right now, is covering this month's Microsoft patches. The second part will cover some myths in IPv6 to get you kind of warmed up for March, which will be our IPv6 focus month. Let's first go over the quick summary of this month's Microsoft patches. I did add MS-13.8, which actually came out in January. This was the out-of-band Internet Explorer patch, which of course wasn't really part of last month's patch set, which is why I added it here. Overall, we got 12 new bulletins that covered something like 50 or so vulnerabilities. Five of these bulletins are rated critical, well, six if you count MS-13.8. The remainder was rated important. Well, let's go over it and first start with MS-13.8, the Internet Explorer out of a band patch. That one, of course, was critical. We probably should rate it now as a patch now, given that there is active exploitation happening of this vulnerability. The vulnerability was originally sort of made public via an exploit of the website of the Council of Foreign Relations. Now, this is not really a targeted attack in a sense that everybody going to this website would have been exposed to the exploit. And that's, of course, why it was so widely known then that this exploit exists and how it worked. Once that exploit was used on the Council of Foreign Relations site, then, of course, it made its way into other exploit kits, which then motivated Microsoft to come out with this out-of-band patch. However, the exploit itself has been seen in more targeted attacks since December 2012. The real difference here is the more targeted attack, you would have a link to an individual or to a group of individuals directing them to the website that will then launch the exploit, while the Council of Foreign Relations attack was something called sort of a watering hole attack. You do target a particular group of individuals, but you don't really have any control who is going to this site. You just assume that people who are interested in foreign politics, who are involved in foreign politics, will visit this site. Another sort of lesson learned here is that you should update your browser. You should stick with the most recent version, not just within the version of browser that you're using. A lot of people still use Internet Explorer 8. However, we are now at Internet Explorer 10. Well, if you're using Windows 8, you do have Internet Explorer 10 by default, but older versions of Windows frequently use older browser versions. Windows XP, of course, can only use Internet Explorer 8, can't use Internet Explorer 9 or 10. The reason why I'm saying this is that modern browsers tend to be less likely to be vulnerable to some of these exploits just because they do include some of the compile techniques and such that make exploitation harder. Doesn't prevent it in all cases, and we'll talk later about some issues where it doesn't work, but in this case, using Internet Explorer 10 would have protected you. Now, then, in addition to this out-of-band patch, we also have a regular Internet Explorer cumulative update. This is the roll-up patch that we typically have sort of every month or every other month. This issue particular goes after use after free vulnerabilities. All but one of the vulnerabilities being patched here is a use after free vulnerability. And let's talk a little bit about these use after free vulnerabilities. I have the URL here for a nice blog post that covers them. But really what this is about is the software, in this case in Explorer, trying to execute a method that's associated with an object that actually has already been deleted or at least marked as free. So what happens here is that the memory content is essentially undefined. If you don't really exploit this, if you run into it by accident, then typically that just means that the software here in an Explorer crashes. A crafty attacker now could fill this part of memory with a code that's then being executed instead of the method that was associated with the now defunct object. So one of the advantages of this exploit technique or this vulnerability is that a lot of the countermeasures that are usually applied to exploitation do not apply. You're not really using a buffer overflow here. So all these stack-based protections don't really apply. You don't really have to do any heap spraying or such that is detected by some of the countermeasures. This makes this a somewhat popular exploit technique. It's not as straightforward and easy to use as some of the other techniques. The blog post here goes a little bit into what you have to do to figure out where the right part of memory can be found. But aside from that, you will see more of this, I think, and we already have in the past seen quite a bit of use after free vulnerabilities. Next, we got MS-1310. This is a memory corruption vulnerability in VML that can be used to execute arbitrary code. Now, typically, this would be exploited via in an Explorer. It is listed as a separate vulnerability here, not part of the Internet Explorer rollup patch, because it's really an ActiveX vulnerability, and ActiveX can also be embedded in Office documents. This particular vulnerability has been used in targeted exploits, so that's why we rated it as patch now. The exploit is already available, even though it's not necessarily publicly known at this point. We got MS-1311. That's a media compression vulnerability. It does affect DirectX, Direct Show. Those are the Windows components that are used to display these movies. The file formats it affects are MPEG and AVI. We have had these vulnerabilities in the past, so you may want to consider a more generic workaround in case there are any more vulnerabilities. However, the workaround here really is to disable this Quartz DLL. If you do so, you will essentially prevent all video from being played back. So I can only see this really being workable workaround in some fairly specific configurations, where you have some workstations or so where people really shouldn't, or where you don't really want them to view a video. MS-1312, that's a vulnerability in Exchange. However, it's really a vulnerability in the Oracle outside in libraries. These Oracle outside in libraries were patched with the last Oracle critical patch update, but now software like Exchange in this case does have to apply this patch. These libraries are used to convert a large number of different document formats into a web displayable form. And then of course other software, and we'll soon see, for example, SharePoint is also affected here. This would exploit the server, not the user viewing the document. So the way this would work is that someone is sending an exploit document to the user. The user uses Outlook Web Access to view the document. But as the user views the document, the server, the Exchange server in this case, would be exploited. And then MS-1313, that's the same vulnerability, just applied to SharePoint. SharePoint, of course, does display documents just like Outlook Web Access, and it does use these Oracle outside-in libraries. Expect other software packages, not necessarily just Microsoft packages, to be susceptible to the same issue. Everybody who has Oracle's outside-in libraries compiled in to their products does have this particular vulnerability. It's actually a fairly large set of vulnerabilities. MS-1314, now this only affects servers, in particular NFS or Network File System servers. You don't have them typically as much in Windows environments. In Windows environments, we do have internet file sharing, which really sort of takes over that role, but it is available in Windows, and if you have a mixed Windows Unix environment, then typically you use NFS to share files. In order to exploit this vulnerability, an attacker would first of all have access to the NFS share, and the attacker needs to be logged in. Only read-only shares are vulnerable here, and the denial of service attack happens if the attacker tries to rename a file or folder on a read-only share. I've used read-only shares quite a bit in the past, sometimes for performance reasons rather than really security. If I have some files I want a bunch of different people to access, exporting them read-only makes things sometimes easier, faster, because you now don't have to be as carefully with locking. For example, if these files are accessed by a database or such, that can be quite useful. MS-1315, that fixes a vulnerability in the .NET framework. We only rated this as important because it's really more a privilege escalation vulnerability, in that it allows bypass of the code access security. CAS can be used to limit what .NET code can do. Now, there are two possible exploit vectors here. The more likely one is via the browser. Internet Explorer is able to execute .NET applications. These are these XBAP applications or XAML browser applications. CAS will limit what these applications can do to the system, and then of course bypassing CAS allows the application to do more damage to the system. It can also be exploited via malicious .NET applications that are, for example, uploaded to a server. Now in this case, for example, you have a shared web server that multiple entities use to offer their .NET applications. You may rely on CAS to separate them from each other, and then of course this vulnerability could be used to bypass this protection. Then we have an old favorite, kernel mode drivers. Not going to spend too much time on them here, but it's pretty much a straightforward privilege escalation. The user has to be logged in order for this vulnerability to apply, and then the user would send corrupt content to some kernel mode driver and then gain system access. The next vulnerability we have here is actually very similar, MS-1317, just instead of kernel mode drivers, here the kernel itself is affected. The vulnerability that's being used here is a race condition. That's something that you have in Unix sometimes too. Essentially what happens here, the kernel does set up a resource, let's say a temporary file, and then doesn't sufficiently protect it. So there is a small window where an unprivileged user could, for example, change, overwrite the file, and then the kernel will use the content of that file in order to execute a privileged operation, assuming that the file didn't change since the kernel wrote it. So this is how these race conditions typically look like. Not exactly sure how they manifest themselves in this example. MS-1318, that's again something different and interesting. That's a vulnerability in the TCP/IP stack, and it's always interesting that we still have these vulnerabilities. Now, this particular vulnerability exploits actually sort of a property of TCP/IP, so it's almost less of an implementation issue than actually a protocol issue, but of course implementations can and in some ways have to work around these issues. The problem occurs in how a TCP connection is shut down. Typically, a TCP connection is shut down using the FIN flag. So one side of the conversation, let's just say here As an example, a mail client that is connected to a mail server will signal, well, I sent you all the mail, I'm done, and it's sending the fin flag. That means the client will no longer send any data, but the server may still reply with, for example, delivery receipts or whatever the server is going to send back. So in this state, the connection is referred to as half closed. The client closed the connection, the client will no longer send any data, but the server may still send data. Eventually, the server will send a fin of its own, and then the connection is closed. What happens here is that the server or the other part of the connection is not just sending no fin, but in addition, the server is sending a packet with a window size of 0, which essentially means keep the connection open. I'm not going to send you any data for now, and please don't send me any data either. So this now leads to the connection being tied up, and as a result, you have a denial of service condition. This is very similar to La Brea. La Brea, if you remember, was the tool Tom List wrote in order to tie up connections being initiated by malicious clients. Now, La Brea does this on connection initiation, so it does it on the SYN-SYNAC. Here it happens on the fin, but the idea is really very similar. The odd part here is that Microsoft rates the exploitability of this with 3, which means it's hard to exploit. I don't agree quite with that assessment. Now, the problem is that the vulnerable side has to close the connection first. And depending on the application, that may not happen. And then, of course, it's not exploitable. But really, I think by understanding the application and by targeting a specific application, you may be able to exploit this pretty easily with a couple lines of scapy. So I think it may be a 1.5 or so in the exploitability. Really depends very much on the application that is being exposed here. Next, we have yet another privilege escalation, and this goes very much with the kernel and kernel mode driver vulnerability. Just here it is, the client-server runtime. The client-server runtime has a similar functionality and similar problems in the sense that the client-server runtime is used to send data to the more privileged side of the operating system. If that more privileged side has a vulnerability, like the case here, then of course an unprivileged user could abuse this issue in order to execute arbitrary code. The client server runtime is particularly used to draw windows. It's also being used to initiate processes and such. So all of these functions of the systems that require privileges, they always are susceptible to these privilege escalation vulnerabilities. Finally, we do have a vulnerability in OLE. Now, OLE only applies to Windows XP, so here Windows XP Service Pack 3 is vulnerable. More modern versions of Windows are not vulnerable. OLE was invented back, I think it was with Windows 95 that first introduced it to allow data sharing and controlling of applications. A typical use case would be to embed an Excel spreadsheet inside a Word document, and that's sort of how it was originally introduced. And now within the Word document, you can essentially edit the Excel spreadsheet, or if you edit the Excel spreadsheet, automatically updates the Word document. So these are kind of the interactions you're looking for here with OLE. In this case, a crafted RTF, a rich text format file, would exploit it. Could be done via Office or WordPad. In Office 2007-2010, you can mitigate this by turning off ActiveX controls in Office. However, you still have WordPad, and WordPad comes with Windows XP. I wouldn't recommend uninstalling WordPad, even though I haven't used it in a while, but it's one of those basic applications that you probably don't want to just blindly remove from systems. So apply the patch and if possible, move to a newer version of Windows. Like I explained earlier with Internet Explorer, Windows XP should no longer really be used, even though a lot of people still like it. Well, with that, let's take a look at our patch order. I rated the out-of-band patch here highest, of course, but when we go to our next set of patches, which was actually released now with the February patch set, the VML vulnerability is rated highest here because it has already been used in targeted attacks. Then we do have the other sort of arbitrary code execution attacks that can be exploited via the web browser, because that's always a very common exploit techniques. 20, of course, only applies to Windows XP. Next, we have the privilege escalation exploits. No particular order here, really. 16, 17, 19. There is no one that's really more dangerous than the other. And then, of course, 18, the TCP/IP vulnerability. Technically, it doesn't really apply to clients because it does require that the victim sort of listens on a port. But still, I would rate it fairly low. And then of course 12, 13, 14 really only apply to servers. Which then gets us to the patch order for servers. The Oracle Outside In library issues, I rated them highest. Exchange and SharePoint, of course, only apply if you actually run those packages. And then we do have the denial of service vulnerabilities, the TCP/IP vulnerability. That one applies to all servers. And then the NFS vulnerability, that only applies to the servers actually running NFS. And then, of course, you still want to apply the remaining patches, but they're not as important for a server unless you regularly use your server to, for example, browse websites. Well, this is part one of the threat update for February. Like I said, there will be a part two, and we will publish this as a separate video, so you can watch either if you wish separately. If you have any questions, please email them to handlers@sans.edu, or then again, if you want to participate in submitting data, isc.sans.edu/howto.html tells you more about that, or just use the contact form on our site. In particular, if you would like to send us malware or attachments, you can upload them via the content form, and it will not go through any virus checker or so that may actually modify the attachment. So that usually works better than using email. Thanks for listening, and talk to you again soon if you're listening to part two. Hello, welcome to the second part of our February 2013 Internet Storm Center monthly threat update. In this second part, I'll be focusing on IPv6, and our title here is Busting IPv6 Myths. What I'll be talking about is various misconceptions that people have about IPv6. And this really leads up to a series of events that we have coming this year, focusing on IPv6, starting in March with our IPv6 focus month. That's something that we at the Internet Storm Center sort of came up with, so it's not a national IPv6 focus month or anything like this. But there are a number of issues that really we want to draw attention to, and this is kind of what this focus month is about. If you have any stories or anything you want to share, we do invite guest diaries for this series. We may do them daily, every other day, whatever way it comes out. And then in June, we do have on the 14th our annual IPv6 summit. Third time that we are doing that, and we are working with some great speakers again that will share some first-hand stories about IPv6, in particular, of course, from a security perspective. And then that's followed by our IPv6 class, which will be sort of the start of a SANS Fire in Washington, D.C. And then again, that's June 14th, 15th, and 16th. So if you want to learn more about this, it's isc.sans.edu/ipv6. This URL will then point to the respective class or summit or whatever we have going on. Well, so a quick outline here about our presentation. We'll start with a quick introduction and then essentially go through a couple of myths here. Whether or not you have or need IPv6, how well it is supported, some of the myths that are still going around about features like encryption, quality of service, and then a little bit about the security issues with IPv6. So, very quick introduction. Of course, the killer feature is the large address space, but really IPv6 is also a big cleanup and modernization of IPv4. IPv4 was developed for a network for the kind of hardware that really no longer exists, and IPv6 in part modernizes the protocol. With that, we do get a streamlined header. This is the IPv6 header. There's a lot of stuff missing that you're used to in IPv4. For example, fragmentation, checksums and such is gone. It's really a much leaner header than we have in IPv4. However, it's also more extendable, and this is sort of one of the real big changes when it comes to IPv6, and that's the introduction of extension headers. Extension headers fit in between the IP header and then the protocol header, like in this example, TCP. You may have several of them. Now, most packets, and I would just guess 98% of packets, do not have any extension headers. They just have an IP header and then a protocol header. But if you want to, for example, do something like source routing, if you have fragmentation and such, if you want to take advantage of some of the new quality of service protocols, then you need extension headers. So you may have one or more extension headers, but they're optional. And just to summarize this introduction again, focus back on why do we need IPv6, what's so different about it. It's really the focus on modern networks, modern hardware. IPv4 was designed around a research network that was built using 70s and 80s hardware. So a lot of it is sort of built around 16 bits, in some cases 32-bit hardware. The packet sizes and such are all sort of in kilobyte increments. Network speeds and latencies are really sort of considered to be relatively slow compared to modern networks. And then, for example, there were no wireless networks when IPv4 was originally designed. IPv6 really overhauls a lot of this. It's built around 64-bit hardware. Everything in the header delineates at 64-bit boundaries. It can take advantage of gigabytes of system memory. And then, of course, it's built for faster networks. It streamlines routing. And then it takes into account things like wireless networks. A lot of these features, of course, were in part sort of retrofitted into IPv4, but never sort of properly integrated. And in many ways, IPv6 doesn't provide an awful lot of new features, but it properly integrates a lot of the stuff that sort of got bolted on to IPv4 over the years. And for example, extension headers is one way this is done. Well, enough of an introduction, so let's talk about our first myth, and that myth is, well, I don't have IPv6. So let me do a quick demo here with a couple of modern operating systems and see how they support IPv6. So let's take a look at how different operating systems deal with IPv6. I got a couple of operating systems set up here as a virtual machine. All of these virtual machines are connected to the VMware switch in the NAT setting, so they don't have any native IPv6 connectivity. If I'm looking here at this Windows 8 system, you will see that I do have a link local only address here for for my default Ethernet adapter. So this could be used then, for example, to configure IPv6 via router advertisements. But I also do have a fully routable IPv6 address here. This is a Teredo detunneling protocol, which is enabled by default in Windows 7 and Windows 8, unless you're connected to an active domain. This system here is, of course, standalone, so this is why this is enabled. Let's take a quick look here how this looks in Windows 7. Windows 7, pretty much the same thing. So if I'm typing ipconfig, I do have my default Ethernet adapter here with a link local address, and I do have the Teredo adapter with a Teredo tunnel address. And then just so it's not left out, let's take a look at OS X. This is the default configuration in OS X, ifconfig, of course. You do see again that I do have a link local address. Now, we don't see a tunnel here. The tunnel will be enabled once you start the back to my Mac feature, and I'm SSH'd here into a second system that has it enabled. And here you do see this UTUN adapter that is being set up for back to my Mac. So it uses IPv6 via this tunnel, even though this particular system here has a full native dual stack IPv6 configuration. It still starts up this tunnel adapter for back to my Mac. And if you want to play with this, just try to turn on back to my Mac in the iCloud setting and turn it off and on and see how this UTUN adapter starts up and then disappears. Now, one question that comes up a lot is whether or not you should disable IPv6 if you don't need it. That's actually a little bit controversial. By default, I would suggest that you disable stuff you don't need. However, read in particular for Windows carefully the IPv6 for Windows FAQ that I have up here and the associated knowledge base article as to how to turn off IPv6 in Windows 7 and Windows 8. The problem you run into is that it's no longer an officially supported and tested configuration if you do so. And there is a specific reason for that. In order to illustrate this, let me show you here yet another virtual system. And that's a Linux system running CentOS. I am just actually SSH'd into it and already kind of crept what I want to show you here. That's just an excerpt from a NetStat. And what you're seeing here looks at first like an IPv4 address, that 10.128.0.11. But if you look closer, it's actually an IPv6 address. Operating systems or modern operating systems internally represent all IP addresses as IPv6 addresses. So just to summarize this, you do have IPv6. You may not want it. You may think you don't need it, but the operating system is really built around IPv6, which gets me to the next myth. I don't need IPv6. That's the reason why people usually ask whether or not they should and how they should disable IPv6. Well, first of all, it may not really depend on you. You may decide that you don't need IPv6, but what about your suppliers, business partners? If you want to keep talking to them and they implement IPv6, they may in the future actually switch to IPv6 only networks, then you're left behind. So it may not really depend on you. For example, a lot of people think that they don't need IPv6 as long as they have enough IPv4 space. Well, if you are, for example, dealing with business partners in Asia that run out of IPv4 space, then you may be forced to move along. And then, of course, there's a whole new set of applications that really will benefit from IPv6. Mobile networks, I put down here, storage area networks, cloud computing, also a lot of security technologies like, for example, end-to-end encryption via IPsec will get easier with IPv6. And in the end, it really comes down to that the alternatives are uglier and worse. For example, a carrier crate NAT I have here, and IPv4 really sort of is running into its design limitations, and a lot of the features that sort of work in IPv4 will be a proper part of the protocol in IPv6. Now, if Windows doesn't even allow us to turn off IPv6, does that mean that your devices, your software can be assumed to be ready for it? Well, sadly not. There's a lot of software in particular out there that's not yet ready for IPv6, that was not written in this IP version agnostic way, and in particular software that's not necessarily networking software, but software that's logging and using IP addresses. For example, your log analysis systems and such, they're the ones that are probably the hardest to enumerate. Essentially, everything that uses IP addresses has to be checked whether or not it's able to deal with IPv6 addresses. And then, of course, even if there may be a firmware update available, it's not necessarily a given that the particular hardware is ready for IPv6 to be able to process it correctly. Just earlier today, I had an issue with my cable modem, and I was looking at its configuration page and figured out that, yep, they loaded a new firmware on it that is now IPv6 enabled. But ever since then, the modem has serious performance issues. So I haven't really 100% verified this yet, but it's very possible that the firmware upgrade that enabled IPv6 caused enough additional overhead to the cable modem to no longer support networking properly. And then you also got some little quirks to be aware of. For example, here I have as an example how to use IP address in a URL. You have to enclose it in square brackets in IPv6. That's for the simple reason that MIME uses a colon as a delimiter. So in an IP address in IPv4, you could have an IP address colon the port number. By putting it in square brackets, you essentially tell the browser that these colons are part of the IP address and not meant to delimit a port. Of course, at the end, after the closed square bracket, you could still have a colon 80, a colon 81, or whatever. And another thing I keep hearing is that with IPv6, all your traffic will be encrypted. Well, that's just not true. The reason why people assume that is that with IPv6, IPsec becomes a mandatory component of the IP stack. In IPv4, you typically have to install something like a VPN client or such, in addition to just enabling IPv4, if you ever enable IPv4. Well, but it being a mandatory component of the stack doesn't mean it's configured. You still have to configure it. That's still not terribly easy. You still probably have to install additional software to do that. So not really a game changer here. However, down the road, by having it as a mandatory component on all systems that speak IPv6, there may be a tendency to enable it more often. And it may also become easier to do end-to-end IPsec versus just a gateway to gateway. Next, we have a quality of service. Now, this was sort of one goal of IPv6, to improve quality of service, and with that also routing. Now, in the IPv6 header itself, we still only have one byte for the type of service, the traffic class, as it's called in IPv6. And really all it does is it follows the more modern differentiated services definition of IPv4. Now, down the road, there are a couple of emerging protocols that you may use to get more fine-grained sort of quality of service features, like, for example, RSVP, the Resource Reservation Protocol. Yes, you can do that in IPv4, but in IPv6 with hop-by-hop headers and router alerts, it's a bit better integrated to the protocol, but it's still not authenticated. With a routing reservation protocol, you can, for example, tell a router that you expect a certain amount of bandwidth to be available. The router may ignore it, or the router may just not have enough bandwidth to fulfill this request. So this is nothing really that's meant for public networks. In internal networks, it may work quite well to sort of reserve bandwidth for video streams and such. And then lastly, probably the reason why most people are afraid of IPv6, and that's the fact that in IPv6, in its default configuration, you will end up with public routable IPv6 addresses on each host. That's kind of the point of IPv6. We now have enough addresses to no longer have to deal with NAT. And of course, for many of us, NAT was a security feature, even though it was never supposed to be a security feature. And then, of course, if you think about it, it just didn't work as a security feature. Most exploits these days that people are afraid of come as an email attachment, as a URL the user clicks on, and they then attack the client. So the user initiates the connection, and really nothing is going to stop the user from going to the respective malicious URL, unless you have something, for example, like a proxy. And well, that's what you can still have. You can still set up a proxy. You don't have to assign global addresses. Now you actually have complete isolation. And I do have another YouTube video about just how to survive without NAT in IPv6 by using something called unique local addresses. And then, of course, firewalls still exist. They still exist for your network. They still exist host-based. Windows by default comes with a firewall enabled on the host. So for IPv4, for IPv6, all inbound connections will be blocked. However, you should become familiar with how to configure this firewall correctly. Whether or not, for example, IPv4 and IPv6 is blocked or opened up if you add a certain rule to it. Well, this is it as far as the IPv6 myths go. We'll have more details during our IPv6 focus month. If you do have any questions, please email to handler@sans.edu or just use the contact form on the isc.sans.edu page. Thanks for listening.